Friday, May 25th, 2007, meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. If anyone in the audience is here for House Bill 3088, we are not going to be taking that up today. We're going to carry that over to our next hearing on Wednesday.
Not anything great.
And I think we will start a little out of order since we don't have everybody here.
She saved her 35.
I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2674A.
I'll go down when you want to talk about amendments.
Okay. And, Teresa, we have a guest committee administrator, and we'll let Teresa tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2674A requires employers to pay amounts deducted from employee wages, either in accordance with law or an agreement that requires or authorizes voluntary wage deductions within 7 days. The bill also authorizes an assessment of a civil penalty up to $1,000 for violations of the measure's provisions. The bill came out of the House Committee on Business and Labor unanimously, but was re-referred to the Rules Committee when it came to the floor on May 3rd because of an amendment that needed to be enacted to clarify the intent of the measure. What you have in front of you are two amendments. The -A4 amendment is from Representative Witt. It requires the employer to pay the required or authorized deduction to the appropriate recipient within the time that's established by law or the voluntary agreement, or within 7 days after the deduction is made if a time frame is not established. And it also establishes the failure to pay the deduction as required as constituting an unlawful deduction. You also have a -A3 amendment from Representative Berger, which allows state agency employees to authorize voluntary pay deductions for contributions to a tax-exempt organization that is designated by agency rule.
Okay, thank you, Teresa. And do we have a sign-up sheet on this?
Yes, we do.
Okay, and I think that, did you want to go first?
No, what we have Mark talk about the original bill, and then,
You'll talk about the amendment. Okay, so let's call Mark Zoltan. Good morning. Welcome
Good morning.
To the Elections Committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Mark Zoltan, Legislative Affairs Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'll keep this short and sweet since the hour is late, so to speak. This is a good bill that came to our attention and Representative Witt's attention when we received complaints from various workers across the state who were having difficulties having deductions deducted from their paycheck, but then not ending up where they were supposed to go. This included everything from child support payments to union dues to charitable deductions to United Way and things like that. So we put together a bill that just set forth the seemingly pretty straightforward proposition that if there is agreement between an employer and employee to deduct something from a paycheck and give it to an organization that occur. We then worked with Representative Witt on setting a time period and the House Business and Labor Committee on setting a time period for doing that we thought was reasonable, which was 7 days. And then there's been a few amendments since then. The agency is supportive of those amendments as drafted, the A3s and the A4s. And I would urge the committee to pass the bill. Thank you very much.
Any questions for this witness? And just to clarify, Mark, the -4 amendments say that the wages the portion that's been deducted has to be paid within 7 days, or if a different time frame has been agreed to with the employee that time.
Yes, that was Representative Witt's desire after the bill went to the floor and some concerns were raised by fellow members. He pulled it back and worked with us on that language. So
great. So you're fine with the -4s. You're also fine with the -3s.
Correct.
Okay. Great.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Escobar.
One question. How many do we get a year on these complaints?
Well, it's hard to say because there was really no way for us to enforce it. We've certainly received several dozen phone calls in the last year or so about folks who had these issues and concerns. And Representative Witt, I believe, was contacted by folks directly and then raised the issue with us. So he actually brought it to our attention. And then we drafted the bill in conjunction with his office.
Other questions for this witness? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And next we'll hear from Vice Chair Berger.
Good
Good morning. Welcome to the Elections Committee.
Madam Chair, you have a distinguished panel before you.
Of straightness.
And modest, too.
For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. I am just tickled to bring you the A3 amendments to this bill. If you look at your language, it refers to the ability to give through payroll deduction to a tax-exempt organization designated by rule adopted by a state agency. Well, what in the world is that? That is the Capital Foundation, the Oregon State Capital Foundation. And since we are in the Oregon State Capitol, it gives me an opportunity to talk about what the Capital Foundation does for this beautiful building. It is dedicated to, through private donations and other means, putting together the extra things that make our capital truly unique and beautiful. The legislature is responsible for the upkeep of this building and the basics. But we know how it is around here. It's hard to get money for extras. And the Capital Foundation works to make this building truly an edifice dedicated to all Oregonians in special ways. Let me give you a couple of examples. Recently, there has been found in rivers and streams scattered around the valley the pillars from the original Capitol that burned down. The Capitol Foundation has found some of those pillars, moved them onto the grounds, appropriately signed them so that all of us can remember and look and be aware of the what happened. There are also other artifacts, I might add, from that original building that we are working to bring back to this building or grounds. The showpiece that I think you all know, of course, from the Capitol Foundation is the Walk of the Flags. That entire thing was done through the Capitol Foundation. It's been a fabulous addition. I think when we all went out there the other day and stood by the Virginia flag and remembered our friends in Virginia, I think we all appreciated that we had the perfect venue and the perfect opportunity. So these are the kinds of projects that the Capitol Foundation is working on. Also, what you may not see in terms of the building, but equally wonderful, is a history project where the Capitol Foundation is taking dictations from some of the former legislators, former governors, former important citizens of Oregon who may lose in the next few years and who have had huge impact. And we are taking oral testimony from them and archiving it in so that we have an oral history of what really happened around important legislation or important things that happened in Oregon. These are all wonderful projects, but you know they all take money. And so what this amendment basically does is allow folks who you will hear soon from another testifier who may want to do this by way of a deduction in their paycheck to have that deduction go directly to the Capitol Foundation. And with that, I'll close, be open for questions, but I think you may want to hear from the really distinguished one here.
Okay, Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Chair, I'm Jim Stembridge. I'm an employee of the Legislative Administration Committee here, and thank you very much for having my testimony. Up where my office is on the fourth floor, right outside, are used to be skylights. In historic buildings like this in capitals all across the United States, skylights were used to light the buildings in the days before there were efficient gas and efficient electric lighting. Those skylights have been covered over. Years ago, there are no skylights at the top of the stairwells anymore. It's an example of some maintenance or restoration work that could be done to make this building more beautiful than it already is. When I, as an employee, am asked to, if I wish to volunteer to have deductions made for the United Way, I have asked in the past if I can do a voluntary deduction for the Capitol Foundation, and the people in the administration have always said they'd get back to me on that, and they finally, the story was that they did not have the paperwork set up for it, but this session they finally said, well, we don't have any authorization in statute for that, and I looked around for a vehicle for that and found none. And then Representative Witt's bill just came into the committee here, and I thought that might be a good vehicle for this small provision, and Representative Witt's been kind enough to allow us to add that. So I'm testifying in support of the -A3 amendment to the measure. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Actually, I wish I had some questions to grill these witnesses. Nothing's coming to mind. It's a missed opportunity.
Madam Chair, Vicki Berger again. For the record, I also spoke to Representative Witt before I ever had this authorized. He was thrilled with the idea. There was very positive response when I said what I was trying to do in this
Great.
Amendment.
Representative Roblin.
I guess a question for Representative Berger. So what you're saying is that Representative, the three Southern Coast representatives who were part of that class of 2005 when we put the money to buy the flag that represents Hawaii, the last of our states in that deal, that we were actually contributing to the fund for the
capital.
And we could have been able to just have it deducted from our salary had this been in place.
I believe so.
Okay. Here we go.
It does require some additional work on the part of any agency that wishes to do this, and my understanding is that the Legislative Administration Committee staff has expressed their willingness to do the extra work to get the Capital Foundation onto options for employees' deductions.
And basically, then, first, there would have to be an administrative rule adopted, it sounds like, and it has to be a tax-exempt organization.
That's correct.
Yes, and Madam Chair, this is the Capital Foundation is a very odd construct. It is an agency. It is a it has not had tax-exempt, but we now have found a way to have it be a tax-exempt organization. So it's the legalities of that are beyond me, but it's been worked very hard. And so this kind of enabling legislation plus some rulemaking and some other things should get us there in a very nice way.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Roblin.
Yeah. So if a person were to become a member of the Capital Foundation and do that, do they then get a discount at the store?
It's the best deal in the world. For a $25 membership, you get a 25% markdown on everything you buy at the.
It's
10%. Maybe 10%. Okay. So I overstated it. 10% discount at the Capitol store. And why every legislator isn't a member is beyond me. So I would definitely encourage you to get your membership to the Capitol Foundation.
Great. Okay, well, we've had a great plug for the Capital Foundation, and I think
I just want to know, where would you get an application?
We'll get
Representative Roblin, one will appear magically in your inbox.
I am confident it will be coming to a mailbox near you very soon. Okay, thank you for your testimony. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2674 and open a work session on House Bill 2674A.
Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the -A3 amendments to House Bill 2674.
Vice Chair Buckley moves the -A3 amendments to House Bill 2674. Is there objection? Seeing none, A3 is adopted. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the -4 amendments to House Bill 2674.
Representative Buckley moves the -A4 amendments to House Bill 2674. Is there objection? Seeing none, amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2674A to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
And Representative Buckley moves House Bill 2674 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Just, Madam Chair, if I could, just thank you very much for this. This is a nice thing, and I particularly want to thank Mr. Stembridge for bringing this to me and to us. It's just a golden thing that he's done.
Made a good deal even better.
Yes.
Okay, Shauna, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Chair Enbaum.
Aye. Motion carries. And we will have Representative Witt carry this bill on the floor, and I'm sure Representative Brugger will want to talk about the amendment. Okay, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2674. And can we do 3539? Okay. I will open a work session on House Bill 3539. Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3539, you have heard a couple of times this month. It requires employers to accommodate to employee religious practices, requires employers to allow employees to use available leave to accommodate employers' religious observance. We have the Dash 5 amendment from Representative Hunt, which requires employers to allow employees to use vacation or other available leave for religious observance and to allow employees to wear religious clothing, take time off for Holy Day, or to use time off for religious observances if doing so does not impose undue hardship on the employer's business operation. And then it defines undue hardship to be an accommodation that would require significant difficulty or expense, including consideration of safety requirements.
Okay, and so you were just describing the Dash 5 amendment?
Yes, that's the Dash 5. We do have other amendments, but I believe that's the one that's under consideration currently.
And members, you should have the Dash 5 amendment in front of you with the staff measure summary. Representative Hunt, would you like to further amplify on the Dash 5?
That would be great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And the colleagues, the Dash 4s that I gave you yesterday, the only change between the Dash 4s and the Dash 5s was just an editorial wording change in line 19 that again adds the words to take time off, just to make sure that the English language reads correctly in that line. Appreciated the feedback from several of you, which resulted in several of these amendments, as well as some groups meeting the committee. You'll notice on page 2, lines 24 through 27 specifically add in an amplified clarification, as Mr. Stembridge said, related to safety issues, to make sure that there is nothing, we're not requiring employers to do something that would result in an unsafe or unhealthy practice for them. This version also explicitly calls out the undue hardship language. It is actually already in statute related to accommodating employees based on disability. So the language, I believe, and Mr. Hendricks is here from Legislative Council, but I believe the undue hardship language is exactly the same with the addition of that safety and health requirement item in line E. In subsection E, line 24 through 27 on page 2. The other major clarification we made in the original version of the bill that we heard last week, there was a broader statement that started off the whole section related to failing to provide reasonable accommodation to religious observance or practice. That has just been much more explicitly narrowed in this language to relate specifically to vacation leave, other leave, ability of employee to wear religious clothing, take time off for a holy day, or take time off to participate in a religious observance or practice, to make sure that it's clear those are the areas that we're trying to protect employees and at the same time not be an undue burden on employers. But Madam Chair, you might invite Mr. Hendricks to come forward, because the one other remaining question is one that Representative Escobar raised related to any potential burden that this might have in terms of clothing requirements related to public safety officers. My understanding, but I'm not the lawyer, my understanding is that this does not impose any additional requirement on agencies employing public safety officers, but I'd be happy to yield, Madam Chair, to Mr. Hendricks.
Great. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council's office. I take it the question, I just heard the question for the first time here, is the impact on clothing requirements, uniform requirements for public safety officers. And I have a feeling that probably that is also going to, you know, I think there's safety issues with respect to clothing, with respect to public safety officers, you know, fairly obvious in that context. And I have a feeling that that would be the out for them when it came down to looking at different types of religious dress that might be involved.
So basically, Dave, the language on page 2, lines 24 through 27, would you think cover that a police department would be able, for instance, to require people to wear their uniforms and not some other attire?
Correct. Also, Representative Chair Rosenbaum, you know, one of the things, it's in looking at whether or not it's going to impose an undue hardship, there's a whole list of factors there that are going to be looked at, and one of them is like in on line 20 there, it's the type of business operations conducted by the employer. And obviously, when you're talking about a police force, it's not so much a business operation, it's a public safety function, and at that point, other factors come into play about what would constitute an undue hardship. And so it's a weighing function in looking and making that determination, and it's going to be hard to say on a case-by-case basis. For instance, it might be a different rule for an online police officer versus administrative staff, you know, in the building where you're not having that, you're not performing that function when you're out there representing basically the city or the state in a patrol car or something, where there might be different considerations than you'd have with other employees of that same employer.
Yes, Representative Reblin.
You know, the Supreme Courts have been fairly clear on the Establishment Clause and with respect to teachers wearing religious garb, and this actually has another part that exemplifies that. Is that not also true in police forces and some of these other public issues?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblem, yes, I think it would be. There has always been a tension, and this is a tension that exists within the Constitution itself, between the requirement of allowing people to do free exercise of religion versus the prohibition on the state establishing a religion. Because every accommodation you look at, you can make an argument, well, that's one step towards establishing religion. And of course, the Supreme Court has never gone there. We have lots and lots of laws that accommodate religion, you know, have withstood challenges based on Establishment Clause. And a great example is the tax exemption provided for religious organizations. I mean, you can make an argument. Isn't that establishing, isn't that giving special recognition? And the courts have always rejected that, said, no, that doesn't constitute establishment. In the case of the clothing example, the whole point with the teacher is that the appearance that is given by a public body when they put forward a person like a teacher, a person of, you know, who stands in front of a classroom and represents basically the public in a very strong role position to influence students, and say at that point if the allowing them to wear religious dress would in fact get you into that issue of establishment. And of course this goes back to a long history relating also to parochial schools and things like that. But there are the same issues that arise in any public, it seems to me, in any public position where people who are basically representing the state, and someone like a law enforcement officer, I think would probably fall in that same sort of category.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Hendricks? And while you're up here, let me just clarify one thing that has come up and I think is now clear in these amendments, that I see nothing in the language of this bill that would allow a teacher, for instance, to refuse to teach a particular subject or allow a particular group of students to request a room for a meeting or anything to do with their duties. It seems now to only pertain to religious garb or taking time off for religious observance. Is that your reading of the bill?
Chair Rosenbaum, it does. We did have more general language in the bill originally, as Representative Hunt pointed out, and that could have been read to be a broader statement with respect to accommodation, and the bill now has been significantly narrowed to talk about leave and dress, basically.
Great. Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And members, we are in a work session. Representative Hunt,
Madam Chair, I would move the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3539.
Representative Hunt moves the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3539. Is there objection?
Vice
Chair Buckley.
Just a comment. I just want to, Representative Hunt, thank you for pushing forward on this amendment. It addressed many of the concerns that were brought up, and I feel much more comfortable with the bill at this point. So thank you.
Great. Further discussion? Is there objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. And Representative Hunt.
I would, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3539 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hunt has moved House Bill 3539 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to congratulate Representative Hunt on the work he's done to narrow this down. I don't think anybody hearing the original bill could object to the sentiment in it, but the devil is always in the details, and it is sometimes, I'm really happy to hear Mr. Hendricks come up and talk about how really difficult this is, because we are into an area of constitutional law that has been discussed and rediscussed and will continue to be discussed for as long as we have our democracy. So these are not easy things, and so I think that we have it narrowed down to a specificity that we can live with. Thank you, Representative Hunt.
Great. Further discussion? Okay, Shauna, please call the roll.
Representative
Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Roland.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye. Excused.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Hunt, would you like to carry this bill on the floor, or Representative Roblin? Would you like to two out of three?
Yeah. I'm happy to carry it.
All right. Representative Hunt will carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3539. And let's see.
That's right.
I think we'll open a work session on House Bill 3270. And Mr. Stembridge, I think we have amendments to this bill.
You do, Madam Chair. And you'll see the date is the 24th of May. We were not able to do a summary of those amendments. This is the measure that you heard in March and then again in April. This the original measure says for offices won by a specified margin or less that each primary and general election requires county clerks to hand count a sample of ballots tallied by machine. Compare the hand count with machine tallied the same ballots. And if the hand count difference exceeds the machine tallied by more than a predetermined margin, to count all ballots by hand. What you have is the dash 4 amendment.
Okay, and I believe we didn't put out a sign-up sheet because this is a work session, but I think we do have a couple of people in the audience who might be able to come forward and explain these amendments. So I will call, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, Representative Greenlick's legislative assistant, and... And John Lindbeck from the Elections Division. And please identify yourself for the record, and please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Powers. I'm here today as Representative Mitch Greenlick's legislative director, presenting the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3270, which were concocted last Friday with Elections Director John Lindbeck here. And also represented from the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition. And I think this reflects, not necessarily makes everybody absolutely thrilled with what we can do, but it does reflect sort of a working consensus. And this is the document that we have come forward to the committee today just to walk through. And I think Director Lindbeck, feel free to chime in at any point and correct me if I'm not correct, because we haven't gone over these together yet. But I think what this does basically is it's modeled after, to a certain extent, H.R. 811, which is federal legislation coming down the pike introduced by Representative Rush Holt. And that bill proposes that states do a manual audit of hand or the paper ballots. So it means we're doing hand counts of the actual paper record of ballots, which that bill also declares are mandatory and will be the official record of any election. So some states right now are doing digital elections, and I think the Rush-Holt bill would mandate paper records and paper trail is what a lot of people talk about. And Oregon, always wanting to be ahead of the curve, is 3270-4 kind of is an attempt to bring that to Oregon before the actual federal legislation passes. And you can see here that there are three different situations under which the Secretary of State will request that the county clerks perform such a manual audit of the ballots. Do you want to go into that, Director Lindbeck?
Sure. John Lindbeck, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. These amendments are a different approach than the original version of the bill, and there were some amendments prior to the Dash 4s, too, that took different approaches. This is what we in the elections world refer to as essentially administrative recounts, where you take a portion of the ballots after the election and hand count them to ensure that the machines that you're using in the election counted the ballots correctly. The difference between this version of the bill and prior versions was how you select that group of ballots that you're going to hand count. The prior versions had more complicated, as you might recall, sort of random selection of ballots. We had our statistician take a look at the prior versions. They had problems with being expensive, untried, untested in other locations, that kind of thing. This approach is an approach that has been done in other states. Arizona and Minnesota have recently passed laws, and the tests, they are tried and tested and went well in those states. And under this approach, the Secretary of State or the Chief Elections Official randomly selects a group of precincts that each county must hand count and a race. Under this bill, the race to be selected would be required to be the race in which that has the most votes in it. In other words, that would be the race normally at the top of the ticket, or the top of the ballot, excuse me. So in a general election, that would be the presidential race or the gubernatorial race or whatever, because they customarily have the most votes. Then one other state race that the secretary would select, and if possible, a state measure. So there would be three races on the ballot that would be subject to these hand counts. And the amount of ballots that would be hand counted are contingent upon how close that race at the top of the ballot was. So if the race at the top of the ballot was really close, within a percentage, they'd be hand counting those races in 10% of the precincts. If the difference between the two candidates at the top of the ballot was between 1 and 2%, they would hand count 5%, and if it was above 2% or greater, they'd hand count 3% of the precincts. This is language taken right from the Holt bill in Congress. Now, why that I think makes sense for this time to do that is that Congress is going to pass this kind of legislation because there are equal bills on both sides, both the House and the Senate, that take the same approach. There's the Holt bill in the House, and Senator Feinstein is putting together a bill on the Senate side, and we've been asked in our office to comment on both of those. They take slightly different approaches about who's in charge of those counts between the House and the Senate bills in Congress, but this approach that those threshold numbers that I just described to you are the same. And I think it makes sense if you're interested in passing an extra test to ensure that our machines count votes correctly, makes the most sense at this time. I think it would not be a good situation if we on the state level passed a test that was radically different than what Congress did passes, because then we'd end up with our clerks having to do two tests after the election. I think that would be onerous and unnecessary. So That's why we think this set of amendments makes the most sense at this time, Madam Chair. The amendments also call for what to do if the count is off. And if the count is off, they do a second recount. And if the count is still off, then they would recount the whole ballot in that county. And that the results only change if you do a full recount. I think that describes what would happen, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Questions for these witnesses? Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lindbeck, this only applies to general elections, and the language in here, I'm trying to frame this right, it says the county clerk shall begin the hand count prescribed in this section no later than the 20th day after the election and complete the hand counts no later than the 30th day. That means that we would have a delay in the certification of the elections?
No, ma'am, that fits into our schedule for full certification. Right now, the counties have 20 days to do their initial count and reconciliation and handling all the ballots that come in late, and to certify those results to us. Then we have, in the Secretary of State's office, 10% to gather all those results and produce an abstract and certify the whole election. This is an orderly way of doing this. The counties would finish their initial count in the first 20 days, excuse me. They do these mandatory checks between the 20th and 30th day, and then if anything comes up, they would recertify to us or amend their original certifications by the 30th day so that everything is finished within the current time frame.
Okay. Representative Baskerville, did you have a
question?
Yes,
I have a couple questions, actually, Madam Chair. First question is, why don't we just wait for the feds to do their thing?
Representative Esquivel, we could wait for the feds to just do their thing, but it's my understanding that advocates within Oregon who brought this bill forward and the sponsor, and they can speak for themselves, that they think it's very important for us to have a test, regardless of whether or not the feds pass anything, that they want an extra test beyond what we're doing now. And so if the feds don't pass anything, we will still in Oregon have something in place. And, you know, that's your policy calls. People are coming forward suggesting that this is something that's needed to assure people that our machines in Oregon count votes correctly. We've never had any evidence that they don't, but we're sympathetic to people's desires to wanting to feel good about their ballot counting systems.
Follow up. Have we gone over these amendments with the County Clerks Association?
The county clerks have not, they were just finished yesterday, have not had a chance to examine them in great detail. They have been told about them. There will be a fiscal on this that I'm sure will exceed the minimum. I think there's a minimum of $50,000 for something to achieve a fiscal. And there is a clerk here who I'm sure would be happy to comment on them. My sense of the Clerks Association is I think it would be fair to say that they have never felt that this extra testing beyond what they do now is absolutely necessary, that they are confident in their voting systems and you know, but if the public feels this is important, they'll do it, of course.
Okay, other questions for, yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lindbeck, on page 2, line 12, when we're talking about the state measure, the language says, if possible, an election contest for a state measure. Does that just mean if there is a state measure on the ballot?
That's the way I would interpret it, Representative Buckley.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. And Mr. Lindbeck, just to clarify the language of the bill, in subsection 10 says that this legislation would go away if the federal government were to adopt a piece of legislation calling for recounts that were at least as strict as the Oregon law.
Right, and that's to ensure that we don't have to do two tests.
Other questions for this witness, these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3270? Oh, yes, yes. We're in a work session, but we will take brief testimony since this is a new version that replaces the original bill.
Sign anything?
No, you don't need to sign in.
Okay.
Just identify yourself for the record.
Chair Rosenbaum and the committee, I'm Virginia Ross from the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. I'm Carla Casey Hansen, also from the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition.
Well, we both are here to support this bill and help move it forward. We strongly disagree with the idea that our method that we eventually adopt in Oregon would be in addition to a federal requirement. That is, I think, just a misunderstanding, and there's a lot of confusion surrounding the current status of H.R. 811, which is the HOPE bill, but there's a specific provision there now that says any state provision audit that is at least as good as or better than the one mandated at the federal level will be allowed as the audit that's required by H.R. 811. I think this is a very important thing for this committee to understand because it makes the argument that you've just heard not really something that should compel acceptance of the eventually of the audit of precincts method, which in our view is not an appropriate method. It's a method, but not the one that will help determine if the outcome has been correct. So that's our main concern, with the caveat that this you need this bill to move forward, and we support it. We're glad for the fact that it has been introduced by Representative Greenick, and we believe it can be done in a cost-effective way. But it's absolutely essential that what we choose as our audit method eventually is something that helps determine what the outcome of the election is, not whether there was a mistake in a machine or a glitch here and there. We're interested in finding out as soon as possible with a high percentage of confidence that the outcome has been counted correctly.
Yes. Thanks, Jane. And we've long advocated for the random sampling of ballots cast and on a statewide, and obviously this precinct methodology would identify that machines or a batch of machines aren't counting properly, but statistically speaking, we're not confident that it would show that it would either verify election results or illuminate anomalies that would occur election roll-wide. And we continue to have that problem with it. However, we strongly advocate that this bill move forward to the House floor. I do have some questions. We were just able to look at these copies of Dash 4 for the first time late last night in the morning. And in subsection 10 on page 4, line 6, where it says subsections of the section do not apply, federal requires post-election hand count of ballots at the general election to verify election results, and the Secretary of State determines the requirements of federal law are at least as stringent. That stringency requirement, to me, that would not, and of course this is interpretation, but wouldn't necessarily indicate that the county clerks would be beholden to doing two different types of tests, but the Secretary of State would be then enabled to determine whether our methodology would be better or the federal methodology. And that's just actually a general question I have about the writing of that section. So that can be illuminated. I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I think I can clear that up for you. I think this language says that it would be up to the Secretary of State to determine if the federal law were at least as strict as the Oregon law. If they determined it was as strict or more stringent, the federal law would be what we would follow. If the Oregon law was stricter, we would go by the Oregon law. So it wouldn't be left either or to the county clerk's discretion. Whichever law what required a more stringent recount is what we would do. Nodding from the Secretary of State.
And then would that be determined as soon as the passage of this and then the whole bill was passed? And
yes. Once the federal law was passed, that determination would be made.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Do you have any other questions?
Well, I hope that this bill moves forward and that there's a way in this process for us to present the reason why the audit of precincts method is not the method that Oregon should use. There are many reasons, and it's a subject for debate, but I hope that that question will be given a very fair venue in the House and in the Senate to make sure that Oregon chooses the best method for our state and our system, and one that truly determines if the outcome has been determined correctly, not just if a machine here or there has gone off. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
I do have one other question. And on page 2, line 5, it was the first reference to batches of ballots, of all batches of ballots. I'm not sure what a batch of a ballot is.
Are you on the amendment?
Yes, I'm sorry, in dash 4, the amendment on page 2, line 5.
All batches, at least of all batches.
Maybe we can ask someone else to come forward after your testimony, because I can't actually answer that
okay.
for you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your testimony. Any other questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you. And I don't know whether Tom or Mr. Lindback wishes to answer that.
John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. Some of the counties sort their ballots by precinct, and then they run them through the machines. Other counties have technology that did not require them to do that, and the machines are able to read what precinct that ballot is from, and so they don't have to do that sorting. So they run their ballots through in batches. Representative Greenlick did not want to have to require under this testing those counties that don't have to sort their ballots by precinct to go back and sort it by precinct in order to do this test. And so that language is written into the bill to accommodate Lane County and Marion County and any others that currently sort by batches so that there was a way for them to test. That didn't require an extra step for them.
Okay, I think that answers the question. Thank you. Okay, members, we are in a work session on this bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3270.
Vice Chair Buckley moves the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3270. Is there objection? Seeing none, amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair?
Please,
Vice Chair Burke.
Did you wish to make a motion?
No, I wish to ask a question of you or staff.
Go
does
ahead.
Does this bill have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
It does not currently have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is that correct, Mr. Stenberg?
That's correct. And we have not requested a fiscal on these amendments because we got these amendments late yesterday. One alternative method for getting the fiscal is to pass the, one alternative is to wait until we get a fiscal into the committee. Another alternative would be to pass the bill out. We would get the fiscal, would have the fiscal before it was returned to the desk, and then that fiscal would be distributed on the floor, and the members could decide as a body what it should go, ways and means, and not.
I'll comment on that. I know, because I have heard a lot from constituents about the strong desire to see a recount method adopted into law, that there's a great deal of interest in this bill. And I also know that my own legislative assistant worked long and hard to try to reduce the fiscal impact of this as much as possible. So I'm confident that we've got a much smaller fiscal than we started with. I don't know what it will be, but I will commit to the members of the committee that if this bill comes back with a fiscal that exceeds a de minimis amount, that we would refer it to the Ways and Means Committee, where it would be considered there. Yes, Representative Hunt.
Okay. And following up on that, we've actually done, especially as we hit the backlog of bills coming out of House committees at the end of April, as some of the fiscals struggled to catch up with the bills, we have made several motions to refer bills to Ways and Means that on the face appeared not to have a significant fiscal, but actually did. So I think we've been pretty open to that. The problem is if we don't do that, then we're going to, with 5 weeks left, we may sacrifice the bill.
I understand, and Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate this discussion. It needed to be had. Put forward, and I'm satisfied that we can move this to the floor and then see what the fiscal is, and then either we refer back to Ways and Means or discuss the fiscal on the floor.
Great, thank you. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3270 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Buckley moves House Bill 3270 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Roblin.
I have decided that I will help move this to the floor. I think it's an okay thing. And having gone through the process with my clerk, I have total confidence in what we're doing right now, and I have confidence in our clerk. So I don't see the same need that other people do with respect to this, but I know that there are people out there who believe there are issues, and I just want to commend what our clerks do. I think they do a great job, and I have a lot of confidence in our voting system.
Yes. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to be a no vote on this, and the reason being is because I'm not sure we just hadn't created a bill looking for something to happen. We in Southern Oregon, I have never been approached by anyone to talk about some form like we're establishing here. Never been approached by any of the people. We have had some interesting situations there, especially in Ashland and Representative Buckley's district, on a council member. But the good thing is the system worked, and our county clerk figured it out.
Well, yes, Representative Hunt.
I would just ask Representative Esquivel, doesn't the fact that Representative Buckley was elected by such a wide margin call into question?
I have to agree with you.
There's probably some suspect in there.
The Buckley input.
And I would just add that I, too, have the highest confidence in the integrity of our election system and the county clerks and our Secretary of State. And I think with vote by mail, we do have paper ballots, so we have a trail that many other states don't. However, we still do have a situation where our paper ballots are counted electronically by optical scanners, so to the extent that they are, you know, technology that is fallible, I personally think this would be a good fail-safe to reassure everybody that the machines are working and we have a system if something goes wrong. So that's why I support it. Okay, further discussion. Shauna, please call the roll.
Representative
Esquivel? No.
Representative
Hunt? Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Excused.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And we will ask Representative Greenlee to carry this on the floor. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3270. And let's see, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 78A. Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 78A allows candidates for their treasurers to designate other persons to sign and certify contribution and expenditure statements. You heard this earlier in the week. You adopted the dash A5, so that is already on the bill. In addition, you have the dash A7 from Representative Thatcher, which allows candidates to designate another individual besides the treasurer to sign checks for political committee expenditures. And during the week, we discovered the bill has a conflict with another bill that is moving, and that is House Bill 2131. And I can give you further explanation of what that conflict is about if you would so desire.
Okay, I think we'll give the members a minute to get their amendments in front of them. So we've already adopted the dash A5 amendment, correct?
Yes.
And you should have in front of you a dash A7 and a dash A8. And I think I can, although Representative Thatcher is not here, I think I can speak to the dash A7 because she raised this point at our previous hearing. This A7 allows check signing to be done in addition to by the treasurer or the candidate, also by someone designated by the candidate to have check signing authority. I think that it was Representative Thatcher's strong feeling that it was cumbersome sometimes to have only the treasurer and the candidate be able to sign checks. And so my understanding is supporters of this bill are fine with this amendment, and I think that's why it's before you. The conflict amendment...
Mark is here to speak on...
I see her legislative assistant, Mark, is here. So would you like to come forward and speak on the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And for the record, I'm Mark Luca. I'm legislative director for Representative Kim Thatcher, who, as you know, can't be with you today. I just wanted to briefly touch on the reason why the A7s were necessary in Representative Thatcher's view. First, it's a simple amendment. It doesn't change the provisions of the bill that the bill intended to change. It's just changing a part of the original law in the chapter. The current law allows only the candidate or treasurer of your PAC, as you probably know, to sign checks, regardless of how many signers you designate for your account. And this encourages some candidates to designate someone like a spouse as the treasurer or the candidate themselves, which can lead to financial issues being raised, like, for example, when the spouse is paid as a treasurer or the candidate wants to be paid for his services and he says, well, I'm normally a whatever and I make this much an hour and so that's what I'm going to be paid. This is because a candidate may want the convenience of having someone close and trustworthy and available to write checks for him or her, but may not want the person to do the treasurer work. So it puts the candidate in kind of a pickle. The A7 amendment would allow the candidate to designate another person or persons to sign the checks for the campaign. My understanding is the Secretary of State's office already asks who the signers are on the checks. However, they're not allowed to sign the checks. Candidates will remain responsible for their own PAC expenditures, and it only makes sense that as a candidate, one would only designate persons they feel are reliable and responsible to for this. Currently, candidates are allowed to give a debit card or cash to another person to spend, but for some reason, ORS 260-054 does not give candidates the same discretion when it comes to expenditures by check. So this amendment has the blessing of all the concerned parties that we could find, and as you know, having a hearing tends to bring out things you didn't think of, but I have heard no opposition, and Rep. Thatcher would respectfully ask the committee to add this amendment to the bill and print it engrossed and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and thank you, and I'll answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions for this witness? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And members, we are in a work session. We have our... Mr. Stembridge, did you want to talk about...
Let me just say a couple more things about the amendments. Each of the amendments is separate, so you could adopt any one of them or none of them or all of them. And the dash A8 resolves a conflict with House Bill. If you look at the dash A8 at lines 19 through 21, you'll see an added sentence there. The list of electors provision in your bill, the addition is the list may not contain any information about participants in the address confidentiality program. That's the address confidentiality program is a bill that you passed earlier in the session.
Okay. Okay. Members, we have already adopted the dash A5 amendment, so we are in a work session. Mr. Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A7 amendments to Senate Bill 78.
Representative Buckley moves the dash A7 amendments to Senate Bill 78. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A8 amendments to Senate Bill 78.
Vice Chair Buckley moves the dash A8 amendments to Senate Bill 78. Is there objection? Seeing none, amendments are adopted. And Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 78 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair Buckley moves Senate Bill 78 as amended by the dash 5, dash 7, and dash 8 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Roblin.
Shouldn't he say it multiply amended?
multiply amended. Madam Chair?
Okay. Yes. Would you like to say multiply amended three
not.
Times?
No, Madam Chair, I still have some discomfort over the $500 charge, and I hope we'll be able to look at that and see what the impact is down the line. But I will be supporting the bill.
Okay. Further discussion. Shauna, please call the roll.
Berger?
Aye.
Buckley?
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Excused. Excused. Aye. The motion carries. And Senate Bill 78. Do you wish to vote on Senate Bill 78?
Vote, right.
We have it.
I'd be happy to vote.
Our motion is Senate Bill 78 to the floor is amended with a due pass recommendation.
Aye.
Representative Hunt votes aye. Motion carries. And we do need a carrier on this bill. Is there a volunteer to carry the bill on the floor? All right. Representative Buckley will carry. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 78. And I think we have only one bill remaining, and I will open.
Madam Chair, you were concerned that we might be running into the floor session, so maybe you better slow down.
That's true.
I'm not concerned that we actually go until floor session. So we're so efficient that maybe we'll get done early. Okay, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2060. And Mr. Stembridge, please tell us about this bill.
House Bill 2060 creates an 11-member commission on legislative campaign finance reform within Oregon's legislative branch. It declares an emergency, becomes effective upon passage. You have the dash 1 amendment from Representative Buckley that changes the membership of the commission to 10, including 4 senators and 4 representatives. It authorizes the commission to submit its report to and it file legislation for the 74th Legislative Assembly meeting in special session.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. Yes, Vice Chair Buckley?
I'm sure it would be all right if I testify briefly on the dash one, just to kind of explain.
Absolutely. Please go ahead. We did vote on a bill. Representatives, while you were out of the room, did you wish to vote on it?
We can. Well, that was quick.
When you were finally passed
it. It was Senate Bill 78. Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
I move that the House, that the rules be.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Open a work session
okay.
On that.
Okay.
Measure.
So I have to close this one?
Yeah, I think
okay.
That's
okay. I will temporarily close the work session on House Bill 2060, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 70. No.
Yes,
Senate Bill 70. We have to have the rules suspended first. So we'll call in Vice Chair Berger.
To open it, you have to have
a rule? Oh, I guess not. I'll open a work session, reopen a work session on Senate Bill 78. And Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I move that the rules be suspended and Representative Esquivel be allowed to vote on Senate Bill 7 as amended.
78 as amended. And Vice Chair Berger moves that the rules be suspended in order to allow Representative Esquivel to vote on Senate Bill 78. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Esquivel, how do you vote?
I am an aye vote.
Representative Esquivel votes aye. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 78. And we will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2060. And Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Peter Buckley, State Representative, South Jackson County. The dash one amendments to House Bill 2060 put forth with the idea that it would be preferable if any campaign finance reform legislation could actually come from this body, that if we could get buy-in from the House and Senate and send something, I would envision sending something to the voters as a referral of how we might enact legitimate campaign finance reform for the state. Currently, we have the experience of efforts going through the initiative process. Then it's been a mixed record. Right now, we have Measure 47 on the books, waiting to come into state law should a constitutional amendment enacting or allowing for 47's limits to come through. So the proposal coming forth is to change the numbers and membership of the commission to have four senators, have four state representatives. And I put in two members of the public, but after discussions with our folks interested in this, I'd be amenable to having three, so we'd have an odd number in case of votes that were close. The main reason being, if there's buy-in by legislators, there's much more likelihood that campaign finance reform will go forward in a positive way that would be productive for the state and for this body. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Representative Buckley? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Please rejoin us. We have four witnesses signed up to testify, and I will call on Norman Terrell, Cappy Eaton, and David Buchanan. Please come forward. Good morning. Let's go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm the first vice president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and with me today is Cappy Eaton, our governance coordinator, whom I think will have some ability to pack me up on the history of campaign finance in the state. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League has supported campaign finance reform for more than 30 years. We believe in measures to improve methods of financing political campaigns in order to ensure the public's right to know, combat corruption and undue influence, enable candidates to compete more equitably for public office, and promote citizen participation in the political process. In the 1970s, after the Watergate scandals, Oregon gave up campaign contribution limits that had been in effect since the 1910s to try and experiment in newly popular campaign expenditure limits. When the federal court struck down campaign expenditure limits as unconstitutional, Oregon voters tried to return to campaign contribution limits by passing an initiative in 1994. Then the Oregon courts struck them down as unconstitutional, leaving Oregon with only disclosure laws and some of the weakest campaign finance laws in the country. In the 2005 legislative session, the League supported the passage of some of the strongest and best campaign disclosure laws in the country, resulting in the web-based Orastar system that is now online and improving constantly. However, Oregon politics is still dominated and awash in special interest money that overshadows much of what happens in Salem. Anyone can be convinced of this by just looking at almost any campaign finance report to see tens of thousands of dollars of campaign contributions from special interest PACs, lobbyists, corporations, and unions, followed by a few hundred dollars of campaign contributions from individuals. Oregon voters understand this, and in the 2006 election passed Measure 47 in the hope of controlling the problem. But the voters failed to pass Measure 46 constitutional amendment that was necessary, according to the Oregon Supreme Court, to implement Measure 47. Why was that? The League believes it was because Measure 46 contained in its one sentence a second feature requiring 75% vote of both houses of the Oregon legislature to pass any change in campaign finance laws. Such a vote is virtually impossible for substantive changes. So any change would have to be passed by the voters by initiative. Without this feature, the league believes that Measure 46 would have passed. So we come to the current proposal for Campaign Finance Commission, HB 2060, proposed by the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature. The league is skeptical, but believes this proposal has a small chance of helping with Oregon's campaign finance problems. It is perhaps a last chance for the legislature to work on this issue, because the voters will surely pass a simple constitutional amendment, like SGR 5 that the league supported in the 2005 session, the next time they have a chance. And I'll point out that the league also helped sponsor an initiative that was filed in the last cycle, which is the same language as SGR 5, but chose not to promote it. The league supports HB 2060, but believes that to be successful, the commission must include all stakeholders necessary to ensure passage by the legislature and ultimately by the voters. HB 2060 proposes an 11-member commission to review and to make recommendations to the 2009 legislature. The league suggests that instead of four legislators on the commission, there be eight, four from each chamber and three public members. A shorter timeline would hopefully produce a proposal for the 2008 special session. It would then be possible to refer a constitutional amendment to the voters, to the citizens, for the November 2008 general election. If we appear to be impatient, it's because we are. Voters passed campaign finance reform in 1994 by 70%. The law produced lower campaign costs for the 1996 election cycle, but the Oregon Supreme Court struck it down. And we have endured 10 more years of ever-increasing campaign expenditures, limiting who can run for office and turning off voters with constant appeals for votes. We want the issue addressed quickly, efficiently, and effectively. With the proper charge and motivated commission members, the league believes that this time there is time to develop a proposal by the end of this year. There is no shortage of background information. However, in the past, there has been a shortage of political will. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this legislation.
Thank you for your testimony, and please go ahead.
Members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I think that Norman has outlined our concerns, and we were very pleased to see the amendments which Representative Buckley has brought forward. We believe that the majority of the membership on this commission should be members of the legislature. They should be the ones who could determine what the best method is for going ahead and trying to get some reasonable and effective campaign finance reform. We also would support having three members of the public on that commission rather than two. And we hope that you will be able to discuss this openly and come with a recommendation to move forward. Thank you.
Ms. Goodell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Buchanan. I'm the State Chair of Oregon Common Cause. Common Cause has always been involved in these election law issues back in the early dawn of the Watergate era, when Common Cause was a new organization and kind of fell in line with campaign finance reform as its most salient issue. Common Cause has through independent members and processes often and almost always come to the same conclusions as the League of Women Voters. And in this case, I certainly second almost everything that was in the League's presentation. However, I did disagree slightly with the idea that they were skeptical and thought there was a small chance. I'm less than skeptical, and I think that there is a very good chance that this could be the avenue toward progress on this issue that has confronted and confounded the public, the legislature, and the courts for many, many years. I have also handed out a portion of an interim study from this legislature from 33 years ago. So over 33 years, not that much has changed, including that this recommendation was for a study proposal for the interim. So just an interesting little bit of history to give you the taste of how things have changed and or stayed the same. So I hope you'll find that of some interest in how the same issues were faced many, many years ago. I also want to commend Representative Buckley for his idea of increasing the buy-in from the legislative participants. I think that's probably a pretty good way to increase the odds of success. So I certainly agree with that as well. So with that, I'm also available for any questions if any of you have. Thank you.
Questions for these witnesses, Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm deeply appreciative of this document from 1974. Just looking at the typewritten nature of it reminds us, and that we all jump to the names, and it's quite interesting. I'm going to play the devil's advocate here with this panel for a minute, and with great respect for Representative Buckley, and say, doesn't it appear to the public that you're taking the suggestion of the commission and who said, let's have the public deal with this and have the legislators weigh in, and turn it around and saying, let's have the legislators do this and the public get a little chance at input? In other words, the fox and the hen house thing. Doesn't this appear by making it all legislators or dominated by legislators? You get buy-in, but the fox is not going to get anything done. Just would you respond to that for me?
The point is well taken. I think that what we have seen out in the real-world process is that the legislators have been less than eager to tackle this issue, whereas the initiative community is not uneager to jump into this once again. So I think that the imbalance that we've had in participation is less legislative participation and to a greater extent the activists out there. So I think it's probably a fair turnaround to say, let's let the legislators have a chance to lead on this and put their foot forward. And I think that that change in strategy may produce a change in results as well. So I think it's a positive effort to try and see if that can work.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could respond also, Vice President, Vice Chair Berger. having been involved in this since before 1974, it is important that the legislature be more involved in this. In 1993, the Senate passed legislation that would have established limits, and the House refused to hear it, and that's what led to the initiative in 1994, which the voters passed. We believe that the voters are ready for something to come forward, and it's time that the legislature took the responsibility for doing that. If you don't, it probably will come, but we don't know in what form, and we feel that it would be better for you to really have a good discussion about this, and we feel that it's within your ability to do that. And so, and certainly the League and Common Cause stand willing and able to help you with whatever that effort is.
Any other questions for these witnesses?
Thank you for your testimony. We'll call Janice Thompson and Lynn Lundquist. And I do see a member of the Public Commission on the Legislature in the audience. Yes. Would you like to come forward as well? Morning, please go ahead.
Morning, Janice Thompson, with the newly named group Democracy Reform Oregon. I'm distributing not testimony but rather some handouts that I'll refer to, but mainly, you know, let you read at your leisure later. You do have a 3-day weekend. I can't believe they're giving you a 3-day weekend at the end of the session.
It's an in-district day on Monday.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Maybe I'll have a little bit more time then because it's an in-district day.
Sure you're having a town hall, right?
You're having
We're neutral on this bill as written. We're definitely pleased that the Public Commission and the Legislature recognize the importance of this issue being addressed as part of their scope of taking a look at legislative operations and improvements. And more interested in the bill with the -1 amendments, and was pleased to be involved in some conversations with Representative Buckley on those. I have some additional suggestions. Certainly, as an organization very interested in capital punishment reform, one indication of the problem is, you know, one little factoid from the one of the handouts with the various tables. In the general 2004 election, legislative contributions, you know, came to $12 million. When you break that down by size of contributions by, you know, donors, 72% of the money was coming from people who were writing in aggregate over that particular election checks of greater than $1,000. So increasingly, Oregon politics are just, you know, the dollar figures are ratcheting up and up. As a research organization, I'd be happy to, you know, work with this group to provide more information along these lines. The other handout I provided was our analysis back when we were the Money and Politics Research Action Project last fall. We were actually neutral on 46 and 47, but as has been referred to in previous testimony, this discussion is occurring against the backdrop of 47 having passed and 46 not passing. Lots of discussion about why that occurred and why it didn't occur. We were neutral on it, but and, you know, this is a 2-page summary of our full analysis, which was, you know, 14 pages. In terms of the discussion about the resources being available on that, again, part of the reason I'm providing these is an indication of the resources available, as well as there's just tons of stuff. For example, the Brennan Center for Justice, I mean, has a whole book, Writing Reform. Ted Rettlinger has it. He loves it. I've worked with the Brennan Center folks on numerous other issues. They would be happy to help out. Again, well, as written, I'm just concerned that the bill does not provide adequate assurance of people really being, you know, the key players really needing to be able to dig in. There was a reference to the study 30 years ago. I was doing some research and came across an Oregonian article about another study in 1988. And a few key lines from that. After working for most of 1980, the panel and his advisory working group composed of special interest representatives are sharply divided. Members say it will likely propose some technical changes, but are doubtful whether they agree on much more in their final meeting. There will be no significant reforms. Now, this, again, it's hard from the news coverage to figure out exactly how the panel was configured, but it does seem like it was a panel that was kind of more configured like, as is described in the bill as written. And I think more often than not, you know, that approach is the right approach. But I think I would concur with the previous testifiers in response to Representative Berger's question about it seeming a little odd to have legislators be bigger players in this. But quite frankly, I'm just concerned that if they're not, this is really going to be an exercise in futility. So I would support the bill with the -1 amendments, but make a couple of additional suggestions. One has been noted before, have at least 3 public members, and just partly the original bill did have 11, and, you know, even numbers are problems. And the part of the reason why, like I, you know, indicate this handbook, provided the other handouts that indicate the kind of resources that are available to bring to bear to this discussion, is I think the faster timeline is quite doable. And I think it's really indicative. I mean, again, part of the reason I'm troubled by the bill in its present form is it just seems like that the original timeline is just kind of more like, you know, well, we'll get to it. We'll get to it. And again, with more legislator involvement, you know, a faster timeline, I would argue that the maze in line 8 and 11 should be shalls, would be my other suggestion. It would be an indication that, you know, this is a group that's really being charged to dig in and bring something back to this body. I think it could take the form of a statutory details that, you know, learns from the experiences of developing Measure 47. And those details could go into place upon passage of a constitutional referral, because everybody knows we do need to amend the Constitution to do this. But I think that referral could then, you know, again, benefit from analysis of Measure 46. And I would, so there's just lots of resources available. I think it's time for the legislature to really take the bull by the horns, which is why I think it's important to reconfigure the bill in the manner that Representative Buckley indicated, though I would suggest again those changes to the permissive may to shall, and again having 3 public members.
I think I hear this question. I had the same question. Where was the permissive language you were talking about?
On the amendment, Madam Chair.
The amendment. Okay. The commission may draft and...
Right. Line 8 and line 11.
And you think that should be shelved out?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. Thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing this issue before the public today. The Oregon Business Association strives to rise above the narrow defined special interests as a corporations and businesses in our state. And that's why I'm here today. Somewhat unusual to have a business association, I think, probably testifying on this bill. We actually, with our committee structure, as most associations do, we actually have a committee called Good Government. And that was an evolution as we worked with issues over time. We didn't know where else to put them. They weren't in education or transportation, because such things as the double majority, judicial compensation, open primary term limits, and now campaign finance. There really is a niche there for that. So we actually have a committee that works specifically in that arena. I suppose in one regard, because we are probably looked as one of the special interests, a major special interest, I mean the business community per se. And so why would we be here encouraging a look at how we might change campaign finance, since we may be the beneficiaries of it? The bottom line is simply the beneficiaries of our state to have the proper outcome requires that we have campaign finance that allows, in our opinion, the best people to get elected, and once they are elected, to function within this process apart from the constraints or the influence of the special interest groups. We don't have any preconceived ideas, certainly, of how you solve this issue, because I think that the panel before had a variance of not much hope or maybe some hope of the future. I guess we are optimistic from the standpoint that we think it must be done. And personally, I was one of four people in this state that functioned as a majority minority leader under the campaign finances of 1996. And it was not a pretty picture. I can remember the special interests driving the campaigns out, the independent expenditures, I mean, through the independent expenditures outside of that process. It is a very complicated issue. Does it mean we can't take an attack on it through this commission? I think we must. And our recommendation would be that there'll probably be less legislators on there than eight. And the reason I say that is this, is because the public is the one that's crying out for some change in this. Really, it's the public that's crying out more than the legislatures themselves are crying out. That's why I think we have reduced not affecting us perhaps, but the attainability of being a good, effective body by the public because of losing the public losing the confidence in the legislative process. And so how we would envision this is that you have some legislators on this, but you primarily have majority of the public in there, and then it goes to the legislature for the legislature to actually implement it. I believe that's the right process. We absolutely want the legislatures to implement this in the end and not the public, because that's the beauty of the legislative process, in my opinion. You have such a thorough vetting that you'll get better outcomes than you do through the initiative process in general. So we would encourage the legislature to be involved enough in the initial process so that it gets carried through, but that you really have the public's support behind that in putting that together. Very, very difficult issue. I know I've been part, as you have, of different kind of task force and so forth, and yet the heavy lifting in these kind of issues probably needs to be done in that particular manner. So we're very supportive of the bill in general, and hope that you can move us through the process so that we get started.
Thank you for your testimony. Good morning. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Lang, and today I am wearing the hat of a member of the Public Commission on the Legislature and chair of the process committee that handled this topic and others. One of the things that we spent a lot of time on early in our deliberation was the subject of who runs, who doesn't, and why. And a lot of what we heard and what we talked about among ourselves came down to the word money. Money involved in deciding whether you wanted to run for office because of the requirements to raise enough to put on a campaign and win. And then money came into, if you did get elected, what was the compensation like, and how did that work, and how did it meld into whether you had a real job or a different job outside of your legislative service, and if you didn't, how did that work, and regardless of whether you did or didn't, what were the time commitments that were asked of you, and how did that affect money in your life? So I think this is an extremely important piece of legislation. I'm happy that it is before us today. I hadn't really thought much about the makeup of the group. I guess I would come down on at least a more equal balance of legislators and public members, maybe six legislators, five public, but I would also I would certainly tend to go at least a few more on the public side. As far as the timing of it, while I appreciate the urgency that is embodied in idea of bringing a report to the February special session, if there is one. I guess I would also say, and this is from the experience on the Public Commission, partly because there is so much stuff out there to be looked at and considered, my committee, my subcommittee met on a monthly basis, which for many people was a pretty rigorous time schedule for them, for both legislators and for the members of the commission, as well as for staff, because there is a lot to be done, there's a lot to be absorbed, and you are asking people to take this kind of a task on in addition to what they do in their routine lives. So I guess I could go either way, but I would want to make sure that there is ample opportunity to work through these things. And then the final comment I would make is I think it is absolutely essential that the campaign finance piece be considered only in conjunction with the other compensation issues that were raised during the commission's work, and that is, you know, what's involved in not just the salary but the per diem, insurance, whatever the other benefits are, because that's the only way that I think the public really has any confidence in this kind of a product, whatever this product might be, and would be willing to move it forward. Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to come before you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for these witnesses? Yes, Mr. Berger.
Thank you, Jeannie. This is, you know, pretty narrowly focused, the bill that I'm looking at, on the campaign finance, legislative campaign finance, and doesn't, that I can see, bring in the other issue that you're talking about, compensation for legislators, from my reading.
I don't have it.
My point is this. I kind of share your concern that there's too many too many legislators and not enough public here, and you suggested one way of splitting that baby. How about another way? Is a committee of 13 just too egregious, and could we have 4, 4, and 5?
I'm sure. Can I just call it that?
Yes.
I guess, Representative Berger, my concern would be just the sheer numbers. Can you get something accomplished? I know you've had this experience. I think one of the reasons, though, my concern that when the Public Relations Legislature dealt with this issue, they basically had presented to us back the idea of something has to be done on campaign finance reform in the format of the Public Commission. There were too many, I think, too many people related to, and too much of an agenda that they had to schedule on. And one reason I think it's important not to branch this out into compensation issues is to get a workable group of people together that can focus on the issue of campaign finance reform and get something accomplished.
Well, then that being said, Representative Buckley, how about 3, 3, and 5?
That could work. How about 3, 3, and 3?
Yes, one comment.
So many thanks for the opportunity. I'm really fine to all these configurations. I think the bottom line is I'm really interested in more legislative buy-in, and so, you know, adjusting it in that direction. Also, in terms of the pay issue, another recommendation from the commission did relate to pay. I concur that that's an important piece of the puzzle. I guess I didn't address it in terms of what this group could do, given that, you know, there's some other legislation on that front. And in terms of the timing, I think the shall does not, my recommendation is to kind of shall, does not preclude that there being kind of a step one and then a step two, and that this, there could be some phase two topics that get discussed down the line, along the lines of, you know, the pay and some of the other ancillary issues. But I think before us, in terms of, like, again, doing something, you know, potentially to bring, to send a constitutional referral to the public, to allow contribution limits, you know, this would allow doing that, to put that on the November, as a referral on the November 2008 cycle. And I think some of the interest there is, again, I think the public, in terms of like this, how they've chimed in, they've already chimed in with an interest on contribution limits, both back in 1994 with that 70% vote, just last fall with, you know, the 54, I think, percent vote on Measure 47. I mean, I think there was a lot of confusion about what 47 was, and that vote might have been higher if 47 had been a little bit more palatable kind of package to folks. You know, for example, it was disappointing as a group to be neutral on something like that. But certainly that piece of the puzzle is kind of what's driving my, you know, do it sooner rather than later. But that doesn't preclude continued work by a group like this on those other issues. So just to point that out.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
I just wonder
if
Ginny, now that she had a chance to look at the bill, had a follow-up to Representative Berger's question.
Thank you, Representative Hunt and Madam Chair. I guess I was focusing on what the recommendation from the commission had been, which was to combine these two ideas, and I hadn't really focused on the fact that piece of it isn't in 2060, but I think Ms. Wilson's suggestion is a good one. The language here is broad enough, I think, that other ancillary issues could be included in the work of this kind of a commission, and certainly addressed, if not made actually part of a recommendation for legislation.
And also, this committee does have another bill, which I believe is Senate Bill 700, which does deal with the Public Commission's recommendation to set up a salary commission. So I think that will be heard here shortly. So stay tuned.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd be happy to work with Vice Chair Berger to talk back and forth the numbers here of, you know, who would be part of this effort. And with your permission, bring back that information to you next week.
Okay. That sounds good to me. So let's plan on doing that. And, yes, Representative Roblin.
No, I was just waving to Vern Duncan.
Oh. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And
better keep talking. I think he brought some people in.
He wants some entertainment here.
He wants to see what
you mean. You missed the show.
We're on our last bill. Would you like to testify?
We could have the young people testify because we might get around to it.
That's right.
Now.
See you back. Okay, I will close the... is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2060 today? Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2060. And members, with nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned.